Yale Podcast Network.
Welcome to Chewing the Fat, the Yale Sustainable Food Program's podcast that looks at people making change in the complex world of food and agriculture. Normally, our episodes feature individuals who've come to campus as speakers and guests of our program. With the podcast becoming more regular, we've all thought, what other stories and ideas can we tell? Ones that draw from our local communities, complicate popular trends, or weave together new disciplines. Podcast manager Ashia Johnny presents the first of these episodes, which will be a format we use from time to time. Listen on as Ashia uplifts the work of Black-owned businesses in New Haven.
Black restaurants have been the pinnacle of Black community building for centuries. Recipes have cultural and familial significance, and for the Black diaspora, they are an important piece of cultural preservation. The diaspora is vast and varied, and the recipes, foods, and ways of preparation are just as vast and varied. In New Haven, a city with a population that is nearly 43% Black, food has been a way to bring people together. New Haven is a city rich with Black history. Edward Boucher was the first Black person to earn a PhD in the United States. Black labor helped build this city, and New Haven is home to some of the most diverse and interesting Black-owned businesses and restaurants to this day. Today, I hope to explore a couple of the restaurants/businesses that are fostering community, preserving familiar recipes, and making names for themselves as New Haven staples. I had the immense pleasure of speaking with Alicia Hazel, one of the co-owners of Ninth Square Market 2 Caribbean Style, a vegan Caribbean restaurant on George Street, and Elisa Bowens Mercado, owner of House of Salsa and Rhythm Brewing Company on Whaley and Barnett Street, respectively. Both women have shared with me their narratives, the trials and tribulations of owning a business, and how familiar memory is preserved through community and food. In an era that is fascinated by organic and sustainable food, sometimes it is difficult to tease out the history and the cultural nuance behind the sustainable food movement. While there may be different definitions of sustainable, meaning healthy food, has always been on the forefront of Ninth Square Market's mind. Take a listen to Alicia Hazel's perspective. Hi, Alicia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's so great having you here. I'm a huge fan of Ninth Square. It's an amazing restaurant. You have amazing food. I was wondering if you could give us a little background on Ninth Square and how the restaurant came to be.
The restaurant basically, you know, it was a vision. You know, it's been in the making long before we even opened. So, you know, it's simply out of our love for cooking, mm-hmm. you know, our love for eating, most and foremost, our love for eating good food, healthy food, because we understand, you know, the importance of eating, you know, healthy food and, you know, what healthy food is, which we refer to as, you know, ITL or the plant-based living, which is, you know, known as vegan now. So, you know, we cook a lot. You know, naturally, and, you know, we love to eat. And we noticed that if we don't cook at home because, you know, our family is, you know, vegan, vegetarian, we have to travel, you know, to other places to get food. So a lot of times we were going to New York, you know, they do have a wide range of, you know, vegan or ITL food, you know, Black-owned businesses in New York that we would have to venture out to when we want to go out to eat. So, you know, in doing that, we saw that, you know, we cook, you know, pretty similar dishes, you know, and we saw that that's something that is missing in New Haven. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no food that represents our ITL way of living, which is plant-based vegan lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So we decided that, you know, we can open up a restaurant, you know, to help share that. You know, we're always cooking for family and friends when there's events because, you know, we're not eating certain food. So we always bring our own dish. Everybody raves about the dish, how good it is. So we try to show them, like, look, there's no meat in there. It still tastes good for you. How, you know, good it is for your health, how much better it is for the environment. So we realize that, you know, something like this can thrive because we've seen it done elsewhere. And, you know, people seem to enjoy the food. So why not, you know, give it a shot? So pretty much how it started.
Very cool. You mentioned a little bit earlier this sort of plant-based eating, this plant-based living. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the connection between veganism and Jamaican and wider Caribbean food.
Okay. So, yeah, I mentioned ITL. ITL basically comes from, like, vital, mm-hmm. meaning, you know, eating only foods that are vital to your health that are going to, you know, enhance your well-being. You know, not eating dead, consuming flesh, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. So in the Caribbean, you know, not only in Jamaica, there's a wide range of people who follow that type of lifestyle, but it's just not widely known. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people know of the meat-based dishes, and they are not realizing that there's a whole community. You know, you have the Rasta community who, you know, are more familiar with that way of eating. So that basically is the vegan, you know, lifestyle there. So there is a whole community of these, you know, plant-based, if you want to call it, eaters in the Caribbean, not just in Jamaica. So it's nice now to see that people are getting more of the taste of that and becoming more aware of that.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, since veganism is oftentimes seen as a privileged way of living or something that is not afforded to people of color, people from marginalized backgrounds, how do you see veganism being afforded to people of color right now in this kind of like day and age?
I think people are becoming more aware mm-hmm. and more aware of their choices.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know, previously, you know, people weren't really given the choice,
yeah.
you know, in certain neighborhoods, you're limited to what you have access to as far as food, mm-hmm. especially if you're not of a certain income or if you, you know, you may not have a car, mm-hmm. you may not be able to get to the freshest market. You may have to rely on the corner store. You may have to rely on canned versus fresh. So I think just now more people are becoming aware and that knowledge is helping them seek out healthier options. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of our main points in the restaurant was to make it affordable because that is one of the barriers that prevents people from getting access, you know, to the healthier food.
Mm-hmm.
And those people tend to be those people, you know, who are in the lower end mm-hmm. of the economic, you know, scale.
Yeah. Have you noticed trends in like your customer base or have you noticed people like shifting like their eating styles after coming to Nine Square?
We were so shocked, you know, when we opened the restaurant because initially we were going to have it in a different location, but it didn't work out. And I guess it's for a reason. So we were actually having it in the Fairhaven neighborhood
mm-hmm.
because we wanted to be more accessible to, you know, our community. We wanted our people to have that option right around, you know, right in their neighborhood. We ended up downtown in Ninth Square. And we weren't really sure what kind of customers we were going to bring in, but we see a multitude of people. You know, there's every race you can imagine walking through those doors. We have people who, you know, are on the low pay scale, people are on the high pay scale. You know, it's nice to see that everybody can come to one spot and be able to eat good, healthy food together. And I think not only for us is that, you know, make us more aware, but for people themselves, you know, within the restaurant, we see people form relations that they may have not formed before because they're not, you know, in the same, you know, environment as certain people, mm-hmm. you know, usually. So
since you were just kind of like talking a little bit about wanting to have a place that is like kind of like a community hub and not being able to have that in Fairhaven versus New Haven, or, you know, having to kind of like come to New Haven rather than be in Fairhaven. I was wondering if you could just like talk a little bit about the neighborhood that y'all are in, because I know that some concerns about opening vegan restaurants is that they may contribute to certain waves of gentrification. And I was wondering, because New Haven is such an interesting city socioeconomic wise, you have Yale, you have Gateway Community College, you have like the wider population. Have you noticed any sort of changes in the area since Ninth Square opening or just even like kind of beyond that? How long have y'all have been here? If there have been sort of any shifts in the surrounding community?
Well, I'm from New Haven, mm-hmm. so I was born and raised here.
Okay.
And there's a big difference of how downtown looked, mm-hmm. you know, back then. I'm not going to say how long back then that was, but I noticed there are a lot more restaurants mm-hmm. and a lot more restaurants that are bringing more ethnic food, you know, out. Mm-hmm. Since we've opened up downtown, I have noticed more of a vegan trend around downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So other places are starting to offer the options because they're seeing that that is, you know, something that's growing within the community. I'm sorry, what was the other part of the question?
No problem. Just like thinking about changes in the area, and then I guess like what your take on that whole idea that bringing in like healthier restaurants or more vegan restaurants contributes to waves of gentrification.
So if anything, I believe if you keep the restaurants affordable, that it would help the people, you know, within the community, you know, be able to stay in the community, you know, in some sense. You know, we have to rebuild, but we have to rebuild in a way that's going to benefit, you know, ourselves. And, you know, we hope to see more people open up businesses, you know, more people of color open up businesses within their communities, you know, to help that, to help themselves, you know, rebuild and not be pushed out and, you know, be able to thrive for themselves. Yeah. So, and that's something we notice also. There's a lot more people of the, you know, diaspora starting to realize that they can open up businesses. And I think us seeing each other do it, we start to realize that we can do it. And it's helping the community, I think, grow and thrive more. Yeah. It's just something that we see in talking to, you know, our customers.
So my uncle owns a dance company in Georgia, and that has been open for 25 years, which is a really like awesome feat, especially for Black businesses, all of the kind of like hurdles that Black businesses have to go through. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you have faced, either opening or kind of like maintaining momentum, and some of the things that you're kind of dealing with right now.
So there's many challenges. First of all, you know, opening a business in itself is a challenge. You have to have a plan. You know, you have to have money. So that was, you know, obviously those two things, and the money is more of the challenge. So I think I mentioned a little earlier, it was, you know, we were working on this business like 3 years before opening it, you know, just planning it out, seeking out funding, going through all the, you know, trying to find out what permits you need and so forth. And so many things worked out and didn't work out. And then we ended up actually deciding not to do it. And then eventually we ended up where we are now just by happenstance, if you want to call it. So. But a lot of the challenges, I would say, are making sure you can continue to run your business. You know, when things slow down, how are you going to keep things going? You know, when you get discouraged, how are you going to keep things going? How are you going to keep yourself going when you're tired? And but, you know, you got to stay motivated. You remember why, you know, you're doing this in the first place, and you just have to stick with it. And that's, you know, advice I would give to anybody opening any type of business. Plan it out. You know, look for funding, because that is important, and just, you know, stay motivated and stick with it.
Okay. I know that your restaurant is a family-inspired establishment, and I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how that plays out in your recipes, how you approach customers, what people contribute, those kind of things.
So a lot of the recipes, you know, the way the menu was formed was, it's a lot of things we like to eat, actually. You know, a lot of things we grew up eating. Flavors we grew up eating, you know, flavors of the Caribbean are like the jerk, the brown stew, the curry. We just kind of veganized things, you know, amongst our household and started making these things. And Q, who cooks, he's a chef. He's very talented at bringing out the flavor and enhancing things. And, you know, he thinks about his childhood, you know, sometimes some recipes that he's had, you know, way back home, and then he'll remember and bring it back out. For example, he did a vegan version of rundown recently as a special, which is basically like a fresh coconut. You take it and you grate it, and you produce the milk from it, and you boil that down to create a nice custard, and you cook down your vegetables in it. So, like, we bring out those things that we remember eating, you know, as children. And, you know, coming to this country, finding mac and cheese, you know, that's something that, you know, it's not really typical Caribbean cuisine, but a lot of Caribbean Americans, you know, end up, you know, eating mac and cheese, you know, things like fried chicken. So we did like the fried drumsticks. My mom makes sorrel traditionally, which is a hibiscus drink, you know, every Christmas, you know. So that's something that we sell in the restaurant. And, you know, I learned from making it with her. Other family members contribute as far as, you know, the gingerbread recipes or things like the rock cakes, you know, that we sell. So it's really a combination of everything that we kind of just grew up eating, flavors that we like, you know, our family's giving us ideas like, oh, why don't you do this? So, you know, I think people would like this. So, you know, throw that in there. So it does help to keep things going, make things interesting.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, where do you source kind of like your produce from? Is there like nearby markets or like how does that kind of like process work for your restaurant?
So we are actually quite lucky because I have my family as a farm that's very close by. It's like actually in West Haven. So throughout half of the year, we are able to get a lot of fresh local, you know, organic produce through them, like our peppers, eggplants, tomatoes, you know, get callaloo, which we like to wait until it's nice and fresh versus buying it, you know, in the can, which is commonly used. And then other than that, we do shop at markets. We shop around a bit. We like to buy things, obviously, non-GMO, organic when possible. We do use, you know, various markets around New Haven. But, you know, we try to keep our products very pure and, you know, keep the quality in it because we believe in healthy, you know, pure eating.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I think you spoke a little bit about just like kind of like the historical roots of plant-based eating, particularly in the Caribbean. But I'm wondering, and maybe this is as much a question for me as it is for the podcast, I'm vegetarian, and that's kind of an anomaly in my family. And I was wondering what you would say to elders in the community who are reticent to exchange some unhealthy, but albeit culturally important recipes and foods for more healthy ones. So you mentioned kind of like the mac and cheese one. And now you have this vegan mac and cheese that is delicious, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And how, I guess just like what would you say to elders in our community?
I would say, you know, just give it a try. Be open, kind of understand why, you know, it is kind of vital for your health to make certain changes, vital for our environment to make certain changes, you know, just for us to thrive, you know, as a people. I think that once people realize the food tastes good and it is actually food, then, you know, they kind of overcome the whole, oh my God, it's vegan, it's plant-based, because, you know, honestly, sometimes if you don't even tell them it's vegan and they eat it, they, you know, as long as it tastes good, they're like, okay, like, I can do this. So it's funny because just like you said, being vegetarian is like an anomaly in your family. And it was for us as well. Q's been vegan, vegetarian for like over 20 years or so, and me about 10 years. And, you know, it wasn't common in our family. You know, there's a few people amongst our family, but not many. But now, since we've, you know, shared a lot of our food with them, and even since we've opened the restaurant, you know, my dad's vegetarian, his mom's vegetarian, all of our family eats more plant-based more regularly. And it's, I think it's just because they know it's healthy and it tastes good and they still get the same flavors as their traditional flavors. Mm-hmm. So I would just say to those, you know, give it a try, you know, open your mind, try to understand why it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. We eat from the earth, you know, it's beneficial for us versus, you know, having to put not living substances in our body. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. One thing that you said there, just kind of like thinking about the connection between personal health and health for the earth. I was wondering how sort of framing vegetarianism or plant-based eating in this way, how can this sort of reshape our current ideas of sustainability as a mostly white elitist form of environmentalism or even just healthy eating, you know?
Yeah. Well, we just need to share it more, you know, amongst ourselves because I believe the more people know, the knowledge is really what helps, you know, spread it around. Unfortunately, some of us haven't been able to gain that knowledge in certain ways, whether it's due to your economic status or your education, being not aware, you know, of what environmentalism is, you know, and protecting your environment. You know, I see people throw trash out of their cars, you know, sometimes, and it's like, why can't you just hold that and throw it in the trash can? Because I'm like, maybe they just don't know better. And if they would have known that, you know, is going to sit there, you know, forever, then, you know, maybe they wouldn't you know, do it. So it could be just, you know, the knowledge that we need to bring to people to be more aware of their environment and what it means to be more aware of their environment and being more aware of their health and what it means. But I feel like the vegan trend, if you want to call it, like as it's growing, is actually helping people become more aware. You know, it may start with just looking at their health, but I think eventually they start to realize like it's not just about themselves, that it should be spread, you know, to other living beings, the planet, you know, what sustainability, you know, really could do for us. So,
yeah,
it's just like taking steps. So,
do you think that? I mean, I think that food fosters community. How do you think that your restaurant has, like, been a community space for people? Do you think that your restaurant has, like, been able to build community in that way?
Definitely. Like I said, I see people of all orientation races come together, and they're sitting in one spot, and, you know, they may not do those things naturally. But like you said, it's the food. And your household food brings people together, you know? You all sit in the kitchen and, you know, congregate and talk about your day. So people end up congregating, sitting at a table with somebody they may not know and talking, sharing about their business or sharing about other things that are going on. People talk with us about what's going on. So it does help build a community. And I do think it's helping others to just be more humane to others, which is, you know, goes hand in hand.
Right.
Yeah.
Final question. Wanted to thank you so much for sitting down and chatting with me. I feel like I learned a lot and definitely loved hearing your perspective on just kind of like the connections between food and community and veganism and culture. I usually like to end with asking our guests a question about what is like a misconception, either about sustainability or about, in your case, veganism, that you would like love if this misconception did not exist.
It's funny because it's the whole, like, with the veganism thing, people are like, oh, I need meat. Like, I gotta eat meat. Food doesn't taste good if I don't have meat. So that's the biggest misconception, that along with, like, they think people who are vegan just eat grass all day. Like, that's what people used to ask me, like, what do you eat if you don't eat, you know, you eat grass? I'm like, it's like, you know, I want people to see that this is food, you know, this is what we should be eating. Like I said, eating from the earth, you know, protecting the earth because we need to eat from it. So if that can be like understood, you know, I think that can definitely help, you know, help out. So the biggest misconception is vegan food does not taste good. But there's a lot of restaurants out there now, and it's nice to see a lot more vegan restaurants, you know, come out, and they're doing a really good job of creating delicious food. So just hope to see it continue because, like you said, food builds the community, keeps people together. So,
after speaking with Alicia, I was interested in thinking about the different ways Black entrepreneurs are breaking into new fields. Beer brewing has largely been viewed as a white male-dominated industry, although historically women were the ones who were doing the brewing. Alicia Bowens Mercado joined me to talk about her experience not only as the first Black female beer brewer in Connecticut, known lovingly as Lady Lager, but as a person intent on community building, cultural preservation, and honoring family memory. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
It's so wonderful to talk to you just about being a Black woman in the beer brewing industry, being a Black business owner. And so I was wondering just kind of before we delve into the beer brewing stuff, if you could just talk a little bit about your background, what brought you to New Haven, what led you to open up House of Salsa?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm from Connecticut. So born and raised here, went to college in Boston at Northeastern, but I've always had, you know, deep roots here, especially in New Haven, because now both businesses are owned and operated out of this wonderful city. I'm just excited that Connecticut has been an incredible home for me. And what happened was about 20 years ago, the House of Salsa opened up here, right here on Chapel Street. And so with my ties to New Haven, with my ties to the dance community, I was actually able to, in 2000, was able to open up the House of Salsa. My previous life before the whole salsa, I was a general contractor. So I would go to Puerto Rico all the time to speak to women and minorities in the construction industry, because it was a white male dominated field and people wanted to know, women especially, and then people of color wanted to know, well, how do you knock down doors in the industry? So on a visit, business visit one year, I was in San Juan and I said, oh my gosh, it was just like the people were dancing. It was beautiful. And came home, took a couple of salsa lessons, and then subsequently ended up opening up the House of Salsa 19 years ago, right wow. here in New Haven. So we've been kind of like a staple, people say, in the community for folks that can, you know, dance and want to just go out and have a good time. But more importantly, it really became a place where people of all ages, races, you name it, were able to come and feel comfortable in a place where they were able to just basically get some workout time, but in a fun manner by dancing. So that's how the House of Salsa kind of came to.
Mm-hmm. And are you still involved in House of Salsa?
Oh, yes. Let me tell you something. The House of Salsa is still very alive and well. Mm-hmm. We have classes 6 days a week. Again, we were downtown on Chapel Street for about 15 years, but I just recently moved, about 3 years ago, to Whaley Avenue in the Westville section. So shout out to Westville, very art-driven space in that area. So we do offer salsa classes 6 days a week. So people are still dancing. So got to get those people out there, yeah. you know, dancing and moving and, you know, mm-hmm. the whole, you know, the energy is still going.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, because of the movement and because of your own ties to the New Haven community, have you noticed that... students are involved, like, at House of Salsa, or is it much more, like, New Haven, like, resident-based?
You know what? The wonderful thing is we get both. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was downtown, you know, it was, you know, not even a block away from Yale campus. So I'll never forget the School of Forestry, a mm-hmm. Group of about maybe 65 students.
Wow.
I was like, whoa. I was like, this is amazing. So the Yale School of Forestry came in. Mm-hmm. They would come in every week. And I would literally host a Latin night for them. So the connection to the university has been amazing. I currently actually teach at Payne Whitney Gym. Mm-hmm. So I do their spring semesters, their fall semester. And so we actually, I have, you know, people right now who are in class, who are students, mm-hmm. who are learning the art of Latin dancing. But then, of course, you've got these people who, you know, that are in the community and they want to have something fun, something different mm-hmm. to do. And so, you know, you've got folks that are from all over Connecticut, actually, that come out to the House of Salsa for some professional dance training. Mm-hmm. So it's both. It's a wonderful balance.
Yeah. Speaking of balance, you have House of Salsa and now you have Rhythm Brewing Company.
Yes.
How did Rhythm Brewing Company emerge and how... how is balancing that?
Balancing, and I will, let me tell you, it's a balance, but it's a wonderful balance. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I named the company Rhythm is because I needed to tie my mm-hmm. dancing in with my new passion. So I've got my passion of dancing, and now I've got my passion of brewing, and it's all has come in, you know, together, and people are now finding their rhythm. We say, mm-hmm. you know, when we were branding the company. But about 5 years ago, I was in Cape Cod at a craft beer festival. And I was walking around and there were people having tastings and I was tasting beer and everything was an IPA. And it was just like, you know, I wanted something that tastes like beer, something mm-hmm. normal. Not saying that IPAs don't mm-hmm. taste like beer, but I have a different palate.
Yeah.
And so I'm walking around with my husband and I look around and I'm like, wow, I'm like, there's really not a lot of beers here that I can drink. I'm like, and I looked at him. I said, you know what? I go, I'm going to make my own beer. And I come from a background of female beer drinkers in my mm-hmm. family. So both of my grandmothers, God rest their souls, I'm paying homage to them. That was the motivation right then and there. I'm going to make something that I can enjoy. And then at the same time, make my grandmothers proud that I am following kind of in the lineage of beer drinking females in the family. Mm-hmm. So 4.5 years of research, brand development, and then we launched about a year ago. So we had our anniversary.
Yay!
Yay! 1 year. You know, when a business can make it 1 year, then, you know, that's when you kind of hit your hurdles, you know, your bumps in the road. But 220 locations later, we are just really excited about where the company is going and how it is growing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something that's just so beautiful, and what I've been hearing a lot from, especially Black female business owners and Black female restaurateurs, is this kind of idea of family lineage and respect and trying to bring those traditions forward. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about in your own life, how important that sort of like family lineage and that family memory is in cultivating food and in producing food and making beer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, coming from an, African descent and being African American, you know, our lineage goes back to farmland, to crops. It goes back to Africa. It goes back to even music, where in Africa, that's where salsa rhythms come from. The drum beats. There weren't like these drums that you can go buy, you know, at a drum store right now. People started with percussion. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this goes back generations and generations and generations. So when I look at how strong the women were in my family, I know that they, you know, got stuff from the harvest and they would just with their hands, they would pick it and, you know, they would have to, you know, prepare it. Mm-hmm. So coming from lineage of women who really just kind of dove into either, like you said, food and beverage, you know, I saw that as a child, kind of like, you know, growing up, they liked their good beers. Mm-hmm. They, you know, the men in the family drank more of the spirits, but they really, you know, it was significant to see such strong women in my life that have cultivated just things through what they had gone through.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So it's just now it's just like bringing that kind of full circle and fast forwarding. Another reason why I got into the beer business is because it's a white male dominated field. So when you have women breaking down doors in this industry, it's about, yes, people don't really care who's making the beer. At the end of the day, some folks don't care as long as it's a good product. Mm-hmm. And so we made sure that we created a fantastic product. It's a lager. People love lagers. It's something normal. It's something that 5 years ago when I was in Cape Cod, I wanted to bring back a normal tasting beer, bring beer back to the basics. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like we've got to open up doors into these industries that are not diversified as of yet. And so that was another motivation. And anything that I remember about the women or men in my family were saying, it was just like, you know what, you might be of color, you might be a female, but if you have a vision and if you have passion, drive, anything is possible. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting here with you today saying that, you know what, kind of like stepped out, leap of faith and said, you know what, I'm going to do this. And it has made quite a difference in the country so far, because we went viral.
Yeah.
The Associated Press picked us up. And once that happened, we just started getting calls from all over the country. So it's been incredible.
Amazing.
It's been incredible.
Yeah. And to just consider that y'all have been at this for a year. And
It's a year. Mm-hmm. We literally, it's been a year. And the doors that have opened, really the publicity and the exposure that the brand, people are grabbing onto this brand. Mm-hmm. It's a brand that they really haven't seen before that's owned by a female and a person of color. And they're just like, this is great. We want to support. Mm-hmm. We want to support. Because at the end of the day, this is all about economic development and employment opportunities.
Yeah.
When you can create these big companies like the Buds and the Coronas, and the Heinekens, they've created economic wealth. They've created employment opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so my mission and my goal is to make sure that everyone in the industry is accounted for, but taking it a step further, making sure that women of color and people of color, you know, have access to a brand that they can grow with and build with.
Mm-hmm. I know that, especially being in this industry as a person of color and as a woman of color, that comes with significant hurdles. I was wondering
Absolutely. If
you could talk a little bit about some of the challenges, about kind of like getting things off the ground, and maybe even challenges you face in your day-to-day life.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This is the thing. First of all, when you're trying to get, you know, investors, we'll start from kind of like the beginning. Because thank God for a supportive family and, just support from a community and people that know me. It's just like, if I'm going to get into this, I'm going to do this absolutely right. So once you have that support, you know that, okay, you've got everyone that's there supporting you emotionally. So now it's just like, all right, now just put this all into play. But I will tell you, you know, when you're going out and looking for investors and looking for folks to fund a project, it can be a little difficult because number one, it's like, all right, you're going into an industry that they're looking at you like maybe you might not know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Why would I invest this money, you know, in you? So what I will tell young folks, especially of color, that are looking into owning their own business, just do a lot of research. Mm-hmm. My 4 years of research absolutely paid off. I had a business plan in place so that when I put it down on the table, the person, you know, whoever's like looking into investing in your company, be like, okay, she crossed all of her T's, dotted all of her I's. She's got a vision. Why would we not give her that chance? So that's number one, really be connected with what you're doing and be very knowledgeable of that. Mm-hmm. And so getting investors, or if you have private investment, I always tell people, you know, GoFundMe or, you know, there are so many resources out there on social media now where you can raise capital, significant, you know, capital to fund a project. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, once you get over that hurdle of having someone invest in you, then it really is really breaking into an industry that's not used to having someone that looks like you in the industry. And I must say, I have had an amazing experience with the people here in Connecticut. Connecticut's Brewers Guild, amazing organization, who have embraced me, who have embraced the concept of diversifying the craft beer industry. And so when you get folks like that who are behind you, you know, Connecticut Beer, and you've got the Connecticut Craft Beer Girls and Body, like, I shout out to them. I mean, these are just women who love craft beer, who are diving into the industry. When you get, like, you know, folks like that, you know, behind you and embracing, you know, what you're doing for their industry, then that's, you know, that's incredible. But I have run into people who look at me and say, wow, she came in and she really shook up the industry. She's doing stuff that we never even thought about doing. And guess what? They think it makes them look bad and say, oh, okay, you know, what does this chick know about beer? And she's, you know, and she's not even, you know, she doesn't look like us. Well, sorry, I'm here, here to stay, not going anywhere. And you know what? Just think outside of the box like I do. I tell people all the time, you can do exactly what I do. Just don't, you know, look at me and, you know, get upset because I came in and I really kind of, when you shake up an industry, it causes awareness. And sometimes awareness makes people uncomfortable. And so when you have people that are uncomfortable with this whole thing of like what's going on, like this, you know, explosion of more people getting into the industry, you should welcome that. Because then that means that there's more people that will be eyeing your brands and your product. So for the most part, I have been completely embraced by all demographics. It's just been incredible. But I have had those that I've had to deal with and quickly cut ties and relationships because you know that they're not out for your best interest and they don't want to see that little black girl that just got into the beer industry take off and succeed. And so what you do with those people, you just, you know what, you go and you prove them completely wrong and you just keep moving forward. So there's bumps, but I'm going to tell you, it's been delightful. The people that I've met in the industry.
Amazing. Just to kind of shift gears a little bit. Tie things together a little bit because I could honestly listen to you talk all day. But I know that recently you had a trip to the Bahamas.
Yes, I did.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. What was the purpose of that?
Absolutely. So again, when the Associated Press picked up the story, it just really, it went all over the country. And we received a call from a gentleman in the Bahamas who said, you know what, this brand, this product, your story would work wonderfully here. They're like, come on, Rhythm, Bahamas, Carnival. Mm-hmm. They said it's one of those things that's just kind of like a perfect, perfect match. Mm-hmm. So that was back kind of in like April of May of last year. And just last month, I got an invitation to fly down to the Bahamas to meet with the buyers. Mm-hmm. So when you're, you know, on an island, things are a little bit different because then you're going to start exporting. Mm-hmm. So you, but you want to make sure that your product is in the hands of people that are, you know, your perfect fit. So one meeting led to seven. And I will tell you that we are currently in negotiations for getting the product to the Bahamas. We're going to be exporting very soon.
Amazing.
We are so blessed and so honored to have that opportunity to really get the product and the brand out to the masses. But that's going to start a whole island, you know, Find Your Rhythm in the Islands campaign for us. So, you know, we'd start in the Bahamas and before you know it, you know, to hit all of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And so the trip was wonderful. It was a great learning experience because I'm, like I said, again, new, not new as an entrepreneur, but new to the industry. So I learned a lot on the trip, but, you know, it took away a lot from the trip because it was one of those things where, yes, this is a reality. This is a dream that's going to become a reality to actually get a product, you know, into the Atlantis or get it into, you know, the Bahamar, you know, into the local community.
Yeah.
And people like that. And again, they have not seen people that look like them on their island producing, manufacturing, nevertheless distributing a brand.
Yeah.
And so people are very excited about that because I will be opening doors in the Bahamas for economic development and employment opportunities. And that's what I'm most excited about.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love this connection because, you know, you have Rhythm Brewing Co. and that's such a purposeful name and it's such a purposeful title.
Yes.
And you bring that to places where rhythm is so much in our hearts and in our souls and in our memories.
Yes, absolutely.
And you have this amazing connection. I'm wondering, thinking very contemporary, there is this new, I wouldn't even call it new, but I guess this more emboldened push for more sustainable products and to have more organic things that are labeled organic, like out there in the market. And then on the flip side of that, there's this concern that as you're pushing towards sustainability, it's going to increase or widen the gap between who can afford organic and sustainable produce and who can't. I was wondering if Rhythm Brewing is kind of grappling with this sort of issue of making things accessible and affordable and what kind of y'all's perspective is on this sustainable industry.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's a great question. We always look at price point. We always look at recipe development. We're always looking, continuously looking, what's going to be the new, what's going to be the next flavor of Rhythm? What's going to be the next brand? I get people all the time asking me, are you going to make a non-alcoholic product? Are you going to make something? Some people have wheat allergies, you know, are you going to make an organic, you know, beer? Are you going to have something that just, you know, gluten-free? So with that said, our minds and all, everyone that I brew with, we come to the table to make sure that we're tapping into different palates. But in general, we just make sure that the product that we are producing now, we perfect it.
Yeah.
So that when it hits the palates of folks, we know that while we're on, you know, to something. But we really do, to your question, we absolutely make sure that our product is, and I will interject here, I do an unfiltered beer, which has better nutritional value in beer. People are like, there's just no nutritional value in beer. Yes, actually there can be if you produce it unfiltered beer like we do. And lagers tend to be lighter. So, you know, the calorie count drops. So I've kept all of that in consideration, you know, especially being a female, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, we don't gain weight. We don't gain weight in our tummies. And so the unfiltered product and brand really was something that I did more research on. But it's about the sustainability of keeping a product consistent out there with your competitors mm-hmm. and making sure that people are have access to it, mm-hmm. But that, you know, healthier kind of, and I can't tell you all of the ingredients that mm-hmm. are in the product, but we do have some fantastic ingredients. Some local things we will be incorporating mm-hmm. Into our beers soon.
Yeah.
So we're looking at all of that because don't forget mm-hmm. there's always a shift in the industry of mm-hmm. what people want, people, you know, don't want. So yeah.
Amazing. I was wondering if you could just talk about your vision for the next like year, for the next like 5 years. What does Rhythm Brewing Co. look like to you going forward?
All right. So Rhythm, and it's funny, I think I shared this with you. We just over the last 48 hours mm-hmm. Had a social media outlet that has probably close to 1 million followers mm-hmm. share our story. And when that happened, then 10 other outlets picked it up. So we just looked this morning, and we had over 1 million engagements.
Wow.
That came in, mm-hmm. interactions with Rhythm. And so now people want to know in Virginia, in California, mm-hmm. in Atlanta. They want to know in Boston. They want to know in New York, in Jersey, mm-hmm. D.C., Philly, all over the country. Where can we get the product? So our vision is to really to get to that supply and demand, mm-hmm. brew more beer, but really get the message. People are connected with this brand because there's a story behind
yeah.
it. It's just not something you go pick up on the shelf. When you see Rhythm, you'll know that there's someone that's a professional salsa dancer mm-hmm. who actually created this brand and this product, and she's paying homage to her grandmothers,
yeah.
and she's trying to create economic and social equality through a brewing company.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we want. We want to be the beer brand that has literally changed the game.
Mm-hmm.
We've come in, we've tapped into different ethnicities, different people's palates. And I'm talking for beer drinkers that are like these, you know, IPA and these craft beer people.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to them too. We want them to join this movement with us.
No.
So what do I see? If it's any indication of what I just saw in the last 48 hours,
mm-hmm.
With 1 million-plus engagements with the company, then the next year, the next 5 years is to have this brand across the country,
mm-hmm.
in the islands,
mm-hmm.
And all the islands.
Yeah.
People joke with me. They say, you know, Elisa Budweiser's the king of beer. They go, you're the queen of beer. So they've nicknamed me Lady Lager.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would like to have that presence in the beer, you know, world.
Yeah.
And then in exchange, you know, give back to mm-hmm. the community. So start doing some, you know, you buy a 6-pack, then there's a certain portion donated. So mm-hmm. we want to be that company.
Yeah.
But in 5 years, I'm going to say three,
mm-hmm.
Because I think three is a little bit more realistic. I know that we will have made significant leeway in the industry, and more importantly, we will have opened up doors
mm-hmm.
for so many others that are trying to get into this or that are already in it. So
yeah.
we have big dreams, high hopes, and we want to just sell a ton of beer. And we always tell people, drink responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
If you purchase, we want people to just be conscious, you know, of that, support a brand and the vision.
Yeah. So usually I and like the Yale Sustainable Food Program, Chewing the Fat, we like to close out by asking our guests what is like one myth that they would like to dispel in the food industry. So I'd like to like constrict that a little bit for you.
Okay, so, right.
So like what is one myth that you wish would kind of just like go away in like the brewing industry?
The one would be that only certain demographics can enjoy craft beer
mm-hmm.
because that's just not true. There's a movement in, you know, this country. And I don't know if people know this, but women were the first brewers.
Mm-hmm.
Women were. So we're just basically just getting back and doing what we normally would do. It's just comfortable.
Yeah.
It just seems it's very natural.
Mm-hmm.
So, the myth would be just like, you know, there's a place for all in craft beer. It's just, you know, take that and let folks enter and, you know, just and be inclusive and embrace.
Thank you for listening, and remember to check out Ninth Square Market and Rhythm Brewing Company.
I'm Ashia Ajani with the Yale Sustainable Food Program, encouraging you all to enjoy all the flavors New Haven has to offer.
This episode was produced by Ashia Ajani, Allison Park, Thomas Hagen, and myself, Erwin Lee. Mixing by Ryan McAvoy of the Yale Broadcast Studio. Music by Eddie Joe Antonio and Louis De Felice. Artwork by Logan Howard. Program support by Jacqueline Munno, Jeremy Oldfield, and Mark Bomford. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks.